the meeting to order and let the record show that it is 1:30 and that we have the privilege again of meeting jointly with the Senate. And Senator Kukesh, would you like to introduce your Senate members?
Yeah, all the important people in the Senate are here. Senator Pascvan and myself.
And representatives that are present are Representatives Dugan, Representative Munoz, and Representative Johansson, and myself, Wilson. So I would like to recognize staff that are here. Carrie Cooper Ryder is the Senate Recording Secretary, and Nancy Hemingway is our House Recording Secretary. And Sammy Baker is our LIO monitor. And my committee aide is the redhead over here, Becky Rooney. And the Senate committee aide is Nancy Barnes. So before we start, remember, please turn off your cell phones, totally off. If you just put them on vibrate, they still interfere with our IT equipment. So if you could do that, we'd sure appreciate it. And we're continuing our reviews from the Department of Transportation. And we're going to start out with our overview of the Aviation Division. And a lot of people don't even realize that aviation is connected with the Department of Transportation, but it sure is. And it will be presented by Christine Klein, who is Deputy Commissioner of DOT Aviation. So Christine, please introduce yourself and your affiliation.
Could you explain that we're going to have a break? And then we'll go.
All right. Senator Kukesh has just reminded me that the Senate is going to leave after this briefing, and then so we're going to take a brief at ease so that they can go and we can get set up for our next briefing that is with Railroad. So, Christine, do you want us to hold our questions or ask them as you go along?
Because normally the presentations have been done separately for the internationals and our rural aviation, it might be better to hold questions until the end because I do have quite a bit to cover in a very short time.
And maybe you might answer some of them as you go along.
I might, yes.
All right, go ahead. And let the record show that Senator Myers has joined us and Representative Johnson has joined us. So, and I think that's all. So,
okay. Good afternoon. My name is Christine Klein. I am the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. My role is to oversee our airports and aviation. Thank you for having a joint committee meeting. I think this is very helpful. I really express my appreciation to the chairman of both the Senate and the House. What I wanted to do today is give you basically an overview of our aviation system. For those who may not be familiar with it, I've broken the presentation down into three areas. Just a very high level, 30,000 foot sort of view of the status of our airports and aviation. And then I will go into our statewide rural airports, and then lastly, our international airport system. Under the status of airports, I want to talk a little bit about the strengths, some of our aviation concerns, what I am focusing on, and the opportunities we have, and also the future. As I hope most of you know, we are a very large aviation system here in Alaska. It's the largest system in the United States. It is also larger than the Federation, the Russian Federation, we recently found out with our 258 airports. 173 of them are gravel and 45 are paved. We have 22 certificated airports, which are airports that have large numbers of emplanements and generally serve jet aircraft or aircraft with 60 seats or more, to kind of give you a sense of what that is about. 90% of our communities in Alaska are served by aircraft, and over 149 have no access except for our airports. There are 16 times the number of aircraft in Alaska as the rest of the nation per capita, and we have over 10,000 pilots. This is actually breaking news. We haven't finalized the report, but the aviation industry economic contribution to Alaska is 47,000 jobs. We recently found out. We commissioned a study through Northern Economics to take a look through our aviation system plan grant with the FAA to take a look at just what is the contribution to aviation and the whole industry to Alaska. We knew it was large, but we didn't know quite how large it was. If the Department of Labor actually segmented out aviation, they would find that it's the fifth largest sector in Alaska. It contributes, as I mentioned, 47,000 aviation jobs. 2,000 of those are directly maintaining airports. 25,000 of the jobs are directly on site on our airports and directly support aviation, and 20,000 jobs are from the multiplier effect. This basically represents 10% of the jobs in Alaska, one in every 10 jobs, and it covers both rural areas in our villages. Nearly every village has someone working in aviation, as well as our urban centers. So I thought this would be very noteworthy and a good time to point this out to all of you. The report has not been finalized, but the numbers and the information I'm giving you have been. In terms of jobs and economic comparison, to give you a sense on this, we are about 40% higher than the national average here in Alaska for domestic product. So if you looked at what does this mean, $2 billion in direct expenditures are due to our airports. $1.4 billion are indirectly related to aviation, for a total contribution of $3.4 billion to the state's economy. And the gross domestic product in Alaska for the 2007 numbers. And these were very conservative numbers. I wanted to make sure that they would be very accurate and defensible. This represents about 8% of the state's gross state product. In the United States of America, the national number is 5.6%. So obviously, as all of us knew, aviation is very important economically to Alaska, but much more important than the rest of the nation. Some of the concerns that I wanted to mention that we have to keep an eye out on and focus on here in the future as well as right now are primarily the day-to-day operations of our airports. We have 256 of them. We have a $28 million budget, and we bring in about $3.9 million in revenue to take care of those airports. So there's, of course, the great delta there. 96% of our airports have been federally funded. The building of our airports, the construction of them, was almost entirely done with federal funds. That's been great for Alaska, but one of the things we have to keep in mind in doing that is with those acceptance of those federal funds come responsibilities to maintain and operate those airports according to Federal Aviation Administration guidelines. So there are requirements that go with them, and those have to be funded with state funds. Other issues we need to keep an eye out on with respect to our airports are the national economy and the volatility of fuel prices. And in rural Alaska, this is particularly important to keep an eye on because the cost of fuel, for example, last year remain high for over a year because there's only barge access to bring fuel in often. So that price goes much longer than it does. The high price carries on over to the following year. Opportunities for aviation system. What I wanted to point out to all of you is that to have a strong economy, you have to have both a strong transportation network as well as energy. And we have a decent aviation network right now. We just need to continue to maintain it to improve the economy in a rural Alaska as well as our urban centers. Other areas that we see opportunities for are aviation career paths. We have become a training ground for sending airport managers out of Alaska to run some pretty big airports in this nation, and we need to probably take a look at that and figure out how we can retain some of our brightest here in Alaska. Better funding and standards of maintenance for the world's largest aviation system is an area I see as a great opportunity in the future to be putting some efforts towards. Since 1982, we have spent here in Alaska with federal funds $2.5 billion in building our airports throughout the state. In Anchorage alone, we have, we mentioned 1 in 10 jobs for the state of Alaska through aviation, but in Anchorage alone, the numbers for jobs is 1 in 8, to give you kind of a sense.
Kristen, sorry, I do want to mention for the record that Senator Bundy is in the audience and listening intently, so thank you. Go ahead, Kristen. Yes.
The areas that we have been focusing on this past year in particular, under our 10-year plan for aviation, is developing an aviation system plan for Alaska. There hadn't been one done in a long time. There's only been 2 done in this history of the state. And the areas that we're looking at are safety, sustainability of our aviation system, and customer service. The aviation system plan basically sets the vision for Aviation Alaska. It is done nationally. It's a very standard thing done throughout the country. It just hadn't been done much here in our state. And it is paid for with FAA funding. They had wanted us to do it for some time. And so we are using that program and plan to go out and listen to our customers, the public, our industry, and figure out how can we improve our airports and what areas we need to improve and how we can improve those. And the economic information that I gave you a few slides back is how we were able to identify that information on the economic contribution here in Alaska, which had never been done. It had been done for the Anchorage Airport, but it had really never been done for the aviation industry as a whole. Under the safety area, some of the things that we've been doing, and thanks to you in passing the Capstone Loan Program last year, getting equipage into our aircraft for reducing aircraft incidents and improving safety. We have heard there are quite a number of loans, not as many as we would probably like, but there are people are taking up the loan program. Just last month, I saw 3 applications. 2 from Ketchikan and 1 from Fairbanks, so I was pleased to see that. We're also working to improve the mapping systems in Alaska. Our mapping systems are very in great need of work, I think would probably be the best thing for me to say. And we're also looking at putting together some airport construction videos for safety to try and reduce the number of incursions on our airports, which then bring FAA violations with them. I'm also looking at trying to find a way to give our airport employees some technical aviation and airport training. Many of them have had to learn on the job, and the aviation industry is a very complex field, so we're looking at making some improvements there as well. On the sustainability of our airports, as I mentioned, the report on the economic impact of aviation on the state economy is one of the first products we have done in the last 6 months. And we're also looking at how we improve our airport compliance with Federal Aviation Administration grant assurances. Our department has not had a really good record in this area. And so what I am doing with my staff is looking at how we improve that, because the FAA is the funding source for our airports. And so we want to make sure that we improve our compliance records and our compliance actions. So we're looking at land use of airports. Lease rates is another example where we are required to increase our rates. And I'll talk a little more on that later. But we're trying to find a way to reduce them slowly and low and slow, as we've been saying. And so those are some of the areas that we're looking at. We're also looking at what minimum standards are required for airports and what we might do to fund those requirements, the maintenance backlogs, and training and apprentice programs. We have identified so far that we have the smallest funding of any state in the union for the yet the largest aviation system in the United States. So we are looking at some of those things, and hopefully later in the session or next session we'll have more information on that for you. In the efforts of better customer service that we're working on, we're trying to do a better job of listening to our customers. I think as engineers and aviators and technical people, sometimes we probably aren't the best communicators. And so we're trying to improve our customer service with our industry and both within our department and outside of our department. And so we're trying to also explain to people the many, many requirements that we live within for our airports and construction programs, and also helping people find how to maneuver, work through our department requirements, and also find solutions through compromise. We've been doing a lot in that area.
Christine, before you go on to the next part,
yes.
I would like to the record to show that Senator Menard has joined us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Christine.
Now what I wanted to do is drill down a little bit into our rural airports and talk to you a little bit about some of the current conditions, the challenges, some of the projects. I know many of you have questions or interest in some of our projects, and also the future. I hit on briefly the number of airports that we do have. Here in Alaska, we have more airports than the entire country of Russia. 173 of them are gravel, 22 are certificated, which are and 45 are paved. Seaplane bases, I never want to forget those, being from Southeast. We do have a lot of seaplane bases that we often forget about in other parts of the states. And one heliport. The previous slide was a picture of the heliport, which is the only way to get in and out of Diomede. We continue to have 80 airports with less than 3,300 foot strips, which is very difficult to land on. We're trying to increase the size of our runways as we obtain funding, as the aircraft fleet mix changes and aircraft require longer distances. So we have quite a bit of work to do there in the future. And a lot of our villages, of course, would like longer runways, but those are extremely expensive. Of the 258 state-owned airports, there are actually many more airports. And I just wanted to point out that there's actually more than 300 airports in Alaska, but there's 30 that are 30 to 40 actually that are BLM private entity airports run by cities, municipalities, and other groups as well. Some of the challenges that we face in operating our airports are the plethora of regulations, federal regulations with the Aviation FAA and the Transportation Security Administration, as well as environmental regulations, escalating construction costs, and the environmental type issues with both regulations as well as dust and erosion that we're seeing. And then last but not least is our operational demands. As the industry has grown, they need longer hours of use on our certificated airports. They have larger aircrafts, so they need longer runways. And of course, all these things basically equate to higher costs. This slide here on construction, I just wanted to kind of point out that construction has increased. I'm sure you've heard a lot about this over the last year and a half. But in rural Alaska in particular, what I wanted to point out is that, you know, in Southwest Alaska, a lot of the grounds and the soils, the wetlands and the permafrost make it extremely costly to operate and build an airport in Southwest Alaska. So we see even greater costs in those areas. On the environmental area, dust has been an issue in many of our Northwest villages, the Northwest Arctic, and some of the citizens have complained, and the EPA and the Department of Environmental Conservation have done monitoring and found that the particulate levels at times can be high, which can then be a health concern. But it can also, besides being a health concern, can also put our funding at risk for those locations. So that's an area that we have to keep an eye on. There are chemicals and dust palliatives that can be used on our gravel runways that can help with the life of the runway as well as the dust issue. However, those are costly. Some other flood and coastal erosion issues I want you to be aware of. In our villages of Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Newtok, we're seeing a lot of erosion on the coast and having to look at relocating the airports as well as the communities in some instances. So these are other challenges that we deal with in our rural system. Here you can see a house had fallen as the coast had eroded in. It's eroding into the village. Another challenge is our maintenance funding to operate our airports. This particular figure indicates our M&O funding for both our airports and our roads. And I wanted to point out that while we have seen increases to our M&O budget, they've been fairly small and really have not kept up with the CPI, the inflation that has gone on. And at the same time, what has happened is we've had significantly increased regulatory requirements on airports to improve safety, longer runways, more lighting, and other things that are required to keep airports open and operable. But what I did want to point out, while our dollar isn't going as far, and this is a concern to me in operating airports, the $28 million that we use to operate our airports, I think, has done a wonderful job for 256 airports. That's quite a stretch in operating 256 airports. In looking ahead, some of the points that on the rural side that we will need to look at and I wanted to point out is that our rural system is largely built at this time. The network itself, the infrastructure is in place, and it was built with federal funds. But with it, as I mentioned earlier, we have those grant assurances that we now need to maintain those airports too, or lose our future funding. And so I think we're going to be moving from a very necessary transition of basically a build-it kind of era to a maintain and operate it era in the future. Those are some of the things that I will want to bring to you in the future, some of the priorities and focus, and also moving from state toward from state funding from federal funding. And that will require a new funding model in Alaska in order to operate and maintain our rural airports. Currently, the cost has been $28 million a year for those 256 airports. The revenue we bring in, which is primarily from leases, permits, and on a couple of occasions, fuel flowage is very small in the rural system. It's not like the international system. They don't get to charge landing fees. And so we want to make sure we are cognizant of that when we do go about increasing lease rates and other things, which we are doing, that we don't have as many options as the international system does. Funding needs in the future, things that we're looking at is what exactly is that funding need for our statewide system. For the primary airports, which are those airports that are greater than 10,000 enplanements a year, basically 10,000 people getting onto planes, we're looking at about a $427 million program. Our non-primary airports, which would be our smaller airports, that are under 10,000 enplanements a year, is about $900 million. And that is the capital program and does include, as you can see, runway improvements. A lot of that includes the subbase and material for building the airport, increasing the runway safety area requirements that FAA has. So for the total for rural airports throughout the state is approaching $1.3 billion, and the deferred maintenance program is $980 million. Since 1982, we've received $2.5 billion in capital funding, primarily through earmarks and the federal AIP program, which is the Airport Improvement Program. These are all federal funds and have funded 95% of our airports. The general funds have typically been used for the airport's deferred maintenance and some of the life safety programs. Our average annual improvement program from the FAA has been on average since 2001 about $200 million a year in federal funds. The next slide I put in simply to give you a sense of some of the areas and projects that we have covered. I didn't put in our non-primary airports, but there are about 62 non-primary airports. If you're interested, I'll show you the slide at the end of our presentation. And there's about 62 airports and projects not included on this particular list because they're the non-primary, our smaller airports. They're very critical and essential in our transportation system to our citizens, but they are a little smaller. For fiscal year, a federal fiscal year, 09 in the future, what we are currently looking at in terms of funding is $54 million under our first and second quarter, which we're working on right now. And that right now the AIP program is only able to continue because of several continuing resolutions that were passed in Congress. And we are now waiting for a third quarter continuing resolution that must be voted on before March 31st, or we will not have our federal funds for this coming year. Stimulus package that many of you have been hearing about and asking questions on has been changing day to day, hour to hour, on what it might contain and what might the value be. The airport industry has been working very hard to try and get that at about $3 billion for all of the airports in the United States. And here in Alaska, we have come up with about $380 million in airport projects that might be ready through both the regular program and the stimulus program. Other areas here in the future that we need to continue to look at are our safety and security regulations coming down for our smaller airports. The larger airports have dealt with this for many years, but the regulations are now being expanded into our small airports, which will take more time and unfortunately resources to address. And as I mentioned earlier, in our future, I will be back to talk to you more about doing how we are going to operate and maintain our airports and sustain them in the future. Now I want to move to the last portion of the presentation, which is the international airport system. The international airport system was actually established in 1961. Basically, it's an enterprise fund that enables the two international airports to operate more like a business. And it's one system. It's common in other states. We only have one here in Alaska, where you have multiple airports that work together to help fund one another. One may not have as many revenues that can come in or traffic. And in Alaska, it was done because sometimes there's more traffic in Anchorage, less traffic in Fairbanks, and the two airports do not bring in the same types of revenue or the same volume of revenue. And so those before us had a lot of foresight and were most appreciative that they thought about these things and the importance of a system in Alaska because of the importance of aviation and those hubs for getting out to the regions. The AIAS stands for the Alaska International Airport System. It does not stand for Anchorage International, just so everybody's aware of that. But it does consist of two international airports, and that is the Fairbanks International Airport and the Anchorage International Airport. And it basically enables an accounting system to take in revenue, have checks and balances, and redistribute it all within one system within our state government. It also provides an ability here in Alaska, because of our long distances, for aircraft that are going long distance to have diversionary locations that they can go to and still be in the same system. Cold Bay and Sitka are also considered diversionary airports, but they are not operated within this system. An example of how this has been beneficial for us is that we had some very poor weather in Anchorage back in October, and 19 wide-body jet aircraft had to divert from Anchorage to Fairbanks. If that had not been a part of the system, we would have lost that revenue in our system, and then those jets could have gone elsewhere. So it kept the revenues in Alaska and improved the health of the system. It also enables aircraft under operating agreements to be treated consistently, pay the same rates and fees at the two airports. Other strengths of our international airport system are the cargo location. It's strategic basically due to the fact that with the type of aircraft we have right now, you can be 9.5, 10 hours to 90% of the industrialized world. And it also provides for a good fueling stop for those and increases the payload versus range model that we worked under for many years. You can carry more cargo if you have less fuel. So it provides a nice model, and we are obviously in a key location for that. Another strength of our international airport system is that it serves a very diverse cargo market with over 23 different airlines, and not one airline has more than 12% of the market share. And that's very key and very unusual in international airports around the world to have such a diverse base of customers. The cargo operations, this is some of the numbers I thought you might be interested in, and the growth that we've seen over the years. There's been a great growth, and steady growth. From 1998 to 2008, there was a 2.8% increase in landings and a 4.2% increase in weight. And those are two very different concepts. We're actually paid, the revenue for using an airport is actually by weight, the certificated maximum gross takeoff weight in our system. Since 2006, we saw a 6% increase and a 4% increase in weight. Another strength of our international system in our northern area that I wanted to point out is our international passenger emplanements in Fairbanks. While we've lost a lot of international passenger emplanements in the system over the years due to the economy and other reasons, we've seen increases in our Fairbanks market from the Japanese market as well as the European market with Condor. And we're very proud of that. It's been a star in our system and contributes $4 million to the winter economy in Fairbanks, which is very key. A winter tourism market is fairly unusual. Our passenger trends since 98 to 2008 have been also small but steady growth of about 4.7% since 2001. And we serve 21 domestic and international destinations within our system. Our business revenues in the international airport system, which relies only on the revenues brought in, it does not rely on any general funds, I need to point out. Our rurals depend on general funds to operate, but our international system under the Enterprise Fund is set up so it must operate under the fees that it brings in. So very different models. The revenue, if you look at these pie charts, you'll see is a very diverse mix of revenue. Our rurals do not have the luxury of having this kind of mix. They basically only have two revenue sources. In the internationals, we have many sources of revenue. And as you can see, a large portion of that revenue comes from landing fees, from cargo and passenger traffic, as well as fuel flowage fees. And in Anchorage and Fairbanks, the cargo is a very big contributing piece of the puzzle. I wanted to go over some of the fiscal year 2008 activities because there are some concerns that you need to be aware of. Our total landings in 2008, fiscal year 2008, which was July 1st of 07 to June 30th of 08, our landings were down about 5%. Our cargo landings were also down about 5%. Our passengers were actually up, which was a good thing, and our fuel flowage was down. The fuel flowage was down basically because last few months of the year, the economy was starting to shift, and the cargo aircraft were, there were fewer operations. While the international airport system has remained the number one airport in the United States for landed weight in billions of pounds, basically 21 billion pounds of cargo has gone through our airport, and it's number three in the world behind Memphis and Hong Kong. But there are things that we need to be cognizant of and watching very carefully right now in the aviation industry, because we are very closely tied to the global economy as well as the national economy. And because we are a leader here in Alaska, we often forget that in our international system. We are on the front lines when there are changes, unlike the rest of our industry. Both our cargo and our passenger revenues are down over 2008 numbers, and we have seen decreases in the 10 to 15% from the prior year. The areas that we need to be concerned with and watch very closely are both the national as well as the global economic recession, the weakened aviation industry. There's been a lot of bankruptcies in this particular industry, mergers with fewer flights, and other parts of the country, many communities lost air service. Fortunately for them, they have roads. And here in Alaska, we don't have that backup to many of our communities, so we'll need to watch that very closely. And also the fuel crisis. The fuel crisis actually has not just while the cost of fuel has gone back down, the impact will be for a couple of years on this particular industry. Other things we need to keep track of on our international airport system is the heavy debt that the system got into with many of its capital programs over the years, a very aggressive program. And the cargo mid-year projection that I've been watching very closely for the last year, we are looking at basically a decline of 13% for fiscal year 09. And for our passenger traffic, our mid-year projections, we're mid-year right now, will be the Anchorage market down about 11% in passenger traffic and about 3% for our Fairbanks traffic, respectively. The IATA report, which is the International Aviation Transportation Association, reported just yesterday that there was an air freight collapse of 23% in December, and we were seeing some of those numbers. What we have found, because we were on the front lines, we had been seeing these decreases much more quickly than other airports in the world and the country, but they have followed the same trend line. And so that's a really good thing and something that is working in our favor currently. Our response to these issues has been to remain competitive. We have finished up a new operating agreement. I just finished negotiating that a month ago. It had been underway for 3 years. And in that operating agreement, we're looking at a more equitable distribution of cost centers and revenue in our international system, so our international cargo is paying for what they use, and our passenger airlines are paying for what they use. We were still operating under a 1980s model when we had a lot of international traffic in Anchorage. We are also working to reduce our operating budget, and you will see this session that we have made a permanent reduction to our operating budget in the internationals to hopefully make us more competitive. And I want to thank my staff at both airports for doing a great job. They were able to reduce their 08 as well as their 09 budgets. Not a huge amount, but they were able to reduce their operating budgets and are looking everywhere they can to scale back wherever they can. We also reduced our capital program by about $300 million over a five-year term. And we returned, as I mentioned earlier, to a system structure, as the two airports had been operating somewhat autonomously for the last 13 years. So we've returned to a system structure to also help our competitive advantage. Something that I would like to mention is that many airports in the country have not been able to sell bonds. We had a successful bond sale on January 7th, and it was a refinancing of some of our debt that will also help with our competition. We are also looking at our Asian market and trying to figure out what exactly is going on there. We have some great employees who know these markets, but I am also looking at a third-party assessment that speaks Chinese to get a sense on what is actually happening in that Asian market. Another item that I should point out with respect to the system is that we are have provided an incentive for our Fairbanks airports for non-signatory airlines that don't want to sign their contract, that they will pay a premium of 25% if they don't want to guarantee the costs of the airport operations, which is a common concept in airport operating agreements. The signatories guarantee the operating costs regardless of the revenue, and as I mentioned, we just finished that operating agreement here this last month, and I think we had a very good partnership with our airlines at this point, and they were pleased with the outcome. The opportunities that I see is that we have extremely competitive rates and fees in our international system. We're highly competitive with the rest of the world and the U.S., with some of the lowest rates and fees in the country. Our infrastructure is currently adequate for our needs. We have adequate capacity, particularly when we operate as a system. And with respect to our ongoing terminal projects, our on the upper left is our Fairbanks International Airport terminal that is under construction currently. The project is $99.2 million. It is on schedule. It's actually ahead of schedule. It is below budget. And it is within scope, I'm very, very proud to announce, due to some great efforts with our team in Fairbanks. Our Anchorage Airport project is a $207 million program. It is on budget and on schedule and includes both the A and the B concourses. Upcoming projects, as I mentioned, we scaled back significantly in response to the aviation industry difficulties. And we are looking at about a $200 million program over the next 5 years. Much of that work is in the runway infrastructure, which is, of course, where our money comes in. The last thing I wanted to mention is we are remaining competitive and responsive. While there are things we need to be very concerned about and very watchful over, we are very competitive. We are going to continue to cut costs wherever possible to match the earned revenue and the traffic that we are getting. We have maintained our rates and fees, which many airports over the last 2 years have not been able to do. And we have a new operating agreement that actually reduced our landing fees by about 10 cents per 1,000 pounds of certificated maximum gross takeoff weight. And we have a new operating agreement that was developed in partnership with our airlines that everyone, I think, can be very happy with and proud of. Thank you. Are there any questions for me?
Thank you, Christine. I I'm very pleased that you've looked into the future and then have been proactive in some areas. That's fantastic. I'm looking to see if there's any questions. Representative Munoz has a question.
Thank you, Christine. You said that Alaska will be eligible for $380 million in Project Ready money with the stimulus airport stimulus funding.
Actually, that is our $380 million is the all of the projects, aviation projects that would be ready, regardless of whether it is AIP, our normal program funding, or a stimulus. Either way,
oh, okay.
So it'll probably be about half that if you include the internationals in there.
Okay, but is it your understanding that Alaska could be eligible for that amount of funding, or
we're
is that
not
unclear?
Sure on what allocation will come to Alaska, but based on our past averages, we've been about $200 million a year mm-hmm. of federal funding. So I would envision it may be in that ballpark again.
Okay. And then just one
follow-up, Representative.
And Daniels. With your airports, the 30 or so airports that are not state-owned, are they also eligible for those funds?
Yes, they are.
They are, okay.
Yes. Juneau Airport would be an example. It's a municipal run airport. Kenai, Merrill Field, some of those airports that you may be familiar with.
Representative Johansson had a senior moment there. Representative Johansson.
Well, you must have read my mind. I didn't even raise my hand.
Oh, I thought you did.
Well, I'll take the opportunity. On slide 32, it indicated 42% of your revenues were from landing fees, and on your last page, under goals, number one was cut costs where possible to match earned revenue. And I sent you a letter when I chaired this committee last year regarding some landing fees and how much is coming in and what was expected, et cetera, et cetera. And I know you're working on a response. When can I expect a response, and did you have any comments about that, or would you rather wait until you send the letter back?
I think your question addressed the capital program excess revenues and how projects had, whether or not projects had been approved and were within the budget and the revenues coming in. And I have prepared a response. It should be coming to you shortly. We are also we just had our in-briefing for our legislative audit that I think Representative Dugan had asked for as well. And those two items combined will give you, I think, probably more information than you will want. Your request is ready to be sent out just shortly, and I think you'll be pleased with it. We have reduced costs. We have also looked very closely at how we can reduce our debt to keep our rates and fees down, and just had, as I mentioned, a successful bond sale. Seattle Airport could not sell bonds recently, and it's one of the most stable airports in the country. We were successful to refinance some bond debt that we had. We're also looking at how we return excess revenue to the airlines or actually use it to drive down our rates and fees, but we still have to meet all of our bond covenants, and those are pretty strict. Our bond debt is about $700 million.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Passban.
Yes, I believe you indicated that the December cargo volume was down 23%, and my question that I have is, have you asked any of the carriers what the shippers are telling the carriers as to how long, or if that trend will continue, and if so, how long, or do you have a personal opinion as to how long that decline might last?
We have been tracking, and again, this isn't the number of aircraft, it's the weight, the certified weight of the aircraft, which can sometimes get folks. We've been tracking our cargo numbers month over month for the past couple of years, pretty closely, or I have, even though I wasn't in the aviation system any longer. And we started to see the fuel drop off about a year and a half ago in December, November, December of 07. That is usually an indication something has changed, and that indicated that the cargo airlines were already improving their capacity and efficiency, loading up heavier, taking fewer flights, that sort of thing. Since June, we've seen numbers range in the, just month, not compounded, anywhere from 17 to 20% down, lower than the prior year. But the trend line is the same with the seasonal peaks and valleys that occur, like, for example, before the Christmas holidays, typically the number of flights and weight goes up. It's still following that normal trend that we have in our system. It's just lower, and basically it's in the 16% lower range. But there was a hit in December for 22%.
Senator?
Yeah, my question really is do you have an opinion as to how long that trend might continue, or have any of the carriers indicated to you how long they anticipate that trend to continue?
I anticipate this trend will go on for a year. That is my personal opinion, and also what we are hearing from the aviation industry is it will be at least 9 months.
Any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, ma'am. Sure, I have several, and they're all over the board.
Okay.
The first one is, you'd mentioned there was your study was done by Northern Economics. Mm-hmm. We just heard a report from Northern Economics in a fisheries committee that said that that touted the number of jobs. So I'm wondering, if a airline flies a fish, is that job counted twice?
It could be. It depends on how they broke that apart. The statistics were taken from the Department of Labor statistics that breaks the industries down by given sectors. And aviation is not a sector. So, for example, there could be a fishery job that is also aviation, so it could, I'd have to look at that particular report to be able to tell you that, but you can have an aviation job that is tied to fisheries.
So, if I might loosely interpret, we can't depend on either report.
I couldn't comment on that. I haven't seen the report.
Okay, well, that's one. You mentioned mapping. Are you having any difficulties with other departments on mapping? Not to mention DNR or the university, because we have a different standard, we're going a different direction, and how can we as a legislator use the most accurate mapping procedure that we can so that everyone can utilize that mapping without infighting between departments? And if you don't want to answer that on the record, I can certainly understand that.
Well, the mapping portion of my program, I apologize, is very new. We just transferred the safety mapping program from the Division of Military and Veterans Affairs to aviation because it did match our mission and what we're doing more closely. So I'm not as familiar with that as I probably need to be. And I will learn more as the time progresses.
I certainly think you will. and I would certainly lend any assistance I can in that, because I know there's varying technologies and varying ways of looking at things, and we want to make sure that we're dealing with the most accurate one we can, and aviation has requirements the others don't. So
yeah,
I'm firmly coming down on your side on that.
Thank you.
A couple of others, if I could.
Follow-up, Representative Jones.
When you said that the takeoffs, the weight of takeoff was what the charge was made on?
For landing fees, yes.
Right.
And it's actually based on takeoff weight at this particular airport system. We're looking at converting that to landed weight, but it really doesn't make a lot of difference. whether it be takeoff or landed weight for the numbers on the revenue side.
Is that an actual weight, or is that just Boeing tells you that this airplane weighs this much loaded, so it's not an actual weight?
It is not.
Okay. What I was getting to is if it's takeoff weight, we're charging for fuel twice, and I wanted to make sure that we weren't double dipping with, no wonder we have excess revenues if we're able to do that. Or maybe we want to look at it. I don't know how we want to look at it. The other concern that I have is on your last slide where it says utilize excess cash to reduce debt and hold down rates. I'm not particularly interested in operating a for-profit airline or airport. So if there's excess cash, I think that ought to go back to my constituents in the form of reduced landing fees, PFC charges, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm a little concerned about us having excess cash in the government agency.
I could probably spend quite a bit of time on this one. It's not excess revenue as you might think in terms of operating a business. The revenue that comes into the international airports system is dictated by a negotiated airline, airport negotiated operating agreement that the airlines have agreed to and signed on to. Some of the revenues that are collected are also due to the debt service and the amount of money that must be kept to operate the airport in advance of the fees being collected.
In your presentation, it says cash. And cash in business is a very specific.
I will change.
It's different than what you've just described. So I think that would be, I may not be the only business person in the legislature that would pick up on that. And that's all for now, I think, Madam Chair.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of what I hope will be quick questions. I think you said that there's been a $300 million reduction in the capital improvement program for the international airports. Did I hear that correctly?
That is correct. For a 5-year program.
Great. Would you mind giving me the details of what's been taken out of that? You don't have to do it right here. If
certainly, it's fairly easy and succinct. It was an additional runway at Anchorage International Airport primarily. There were some other smaller projects I don't have on the top of my head, but they were fairly minor projects that we could live without at this time, particularly with respect to the costs they were going to have on the rates and fees.
If I might, Madam Chair. And that was this, what was referred to as the third runway, either third 10,000 foot or whatever, however long
fourth
it is.
Fourth runway.
Yeah, but right. Okay. And just one other question. You said that the operation of the airports, that is Fairbanks and Anchorage, the international airports, had been returned to system structure. Would you mind telling me what that looks like on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. The system was set up to have an executive director that basically oversees the revenue and expenditures along with the comptroller and has checks and balances to make sure that there is balanced spending and fair rates and fees across the system and with the airlines. That system, and I've worked under both systems over the years, the past 17 years, that system was changed around 1992, and the executive director of the system was moved into the Anchorage International Airport, basically due to the winds at that time. And so what I have done is taken that position that we have, and I'm currently trying to recruit a system director that will operate our system as a standard system like other systems in the country where you have multiple airports within a system that share revenue resources and so forth, and capacity as well. And both airports already have and have had for some time their own airport manager, and that had been in place and has been for some time. Don't know if that fully answers your question, but currently I am overseeing the international airport system as well as my normal day-to-day duties. We are in the final throes of selecting somebody, I hope, for the international airport system. But until then, I will continue to oversee the system as a whole.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. Just to make sure I got that right. There's an airport manager in Anchorage and one in Fairbanks. And
yes,
there is. Each of those people is more or less responsible for the day-to-day operations of the airport in that particular location.
That is correct. They focus on the operations, making sure the airport is operating efficiently and safely. And the system director, their focus, goals, and priorities are supposed to be on the system as a whole, the policies, relationships with the airlines, relationships with the communities, those kinds
okay.
of things.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
You sure. bet.
I have one question, Chris. When you were talking about how much money that we got from the federal government and that the majority of it came from the federal government, were you including the Homeland Security extra bump that we got in the last few years for airports? Wasn't there quite a bit that came into the state because of Homeland Security?
The numbers that I showed you on the slides did not include the Transportation Security Administration funds. Those have been so far focused primarily on the law enforcement areas, helping provide law enforcement funds at our certificated airports. We are working hard to try and get the TSA to reimburse us, however, for some of the security requirements that were put on the airports for baggage screening. There were significant costs, and particularly at the Anchorage Airport with the Sea Concourse, there was about $20 million that had to go into security screening that has not been reimbursed to this day. And we are working on that. I am working on that right now as well, and we're hoping that that will be covered in the stimulus program.
Okay, thank you. And we're going to, I think, I'm sorry, but we've got, hold that, and we will have her answer that, and I'll pass it around, because right now we have to take a brief at ease and let the Senate go where they need to go and get set up for the railroad presentation, and they only have a short time, and so I'm going to do that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And maybe, Kathy, maybe you'll have time to go. And now we'll move on to our second agenda item, the Alaska Railroad. And we will have a presentation by Pat Gamble. And he is the president and CEO of the railroad. And I know that hopefully we'll have some members come back in, but the Senate had other meetings that they had to go to. So, Pat, please introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record. And would you like to ask questions as you go along, or wait until the end?
Madam Chair, I can do it either way. I've actually structured it to be brief up front and offer maximum time for questions. But I'll defer to your.
What are the wishes of the committee?
It's adjourned.
I'll remember not to ask you that again.
Never supposed to tell the truth about that.
Okay. Well, then we'll go ahead, and if you've kind of did your presentation so that you could go through it and then us ask questions, we'll do that. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Gamble. I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, where I've been now for going on 8 years. I appreciate the opportunity to come today and kind of give you an overview of what's going on with the railroad. I'm sure it's going to be sort of a derivative of the same kind of things you've been hearing from other businesses, a little bit different key, but basically the ups and downs of all the graphs are probably looking quite the same. So I'm going to travel over that lightly. I'm going to give you a couple of of numbers up front, a little bit about personnel, and then I'm going to anticipate some questions that you're probably going to have in areas that your constituents might be talking about. Certainly Flint Hills is one of those that involves a railroad, and certainly the stimulus package is another one that involves a railroad, and I can talk to some of those if you'd like. The 2008 results, you have in your packet a report to the state of Alaska, which is a legislative report that by law we give every year. The numbers are unaudited and won't be until for another month or so, but they're close. They're very close. We pretty much know how things have turned out. And those are all in there. I would like to highlight a couple of points in there. We've seen an economic downturn in terms of just overall business coming into Alaska, and we've felt that. We have a tendency to focus on our biggest customer, which is the Flint Hills Refinery in North Pole, a refinery in which at the peak we were moving 1 billion gallons of jet fuel to the airport, and you've just heard that discussed there. That's the draw on our biggest customer. We're now down to probably somewhere in the neighborhood of south of 700 million gallons, probably closer to 600 million gallons in terms of the reduction overall. And because that's a high margin product, that goes straight to the bottom line when we don't move those rail cars. And if you think about it, what you do is you take a 100 car train and you cut down to 85 cars and you run the same train with the same expenses and the same crew, you're just not moving as much product. And so that really is bottom line without an associated expense. It's been tough on the railroad, and we've been working hard to offset that, trying to develop other business. Nevertheless, we've had some other reductions that we've noticed. Cargo shipped by trailers, what we call Topsy and Copsy trailers on flat cars and the containers themselves, is down about 12%. Flint Hills just in 08 alone was down 14%, and this is about the third year we've seen them go down. On the upside, we actually moved more gravel this year than we thought. We generally kind of go with the flow of DOT to a large degree, and of course, development of things like shopping centers and so on. And actually, that wasn't a bad year for us this year, all things considered. I guess the one we're really happy and surprised about is export coal. We have a pretty good interior coal movement. But export coal took a real hit a few years ago when the Korean market dried up. And we've gone back out now and really marketed with Usabelli. We partnered much closer with them down in Seward to operate our coal terminal. And what we've seen is a pickup in spot market coal. Spot market coal is very short notice. It's typically higher priced. Without that long contract, they'll go out and look for an opportunity to buy to give a customer. And there are brokers that do that. And then they'll send a ship in on short notice, and we'll take some train loads of coal down to Seward and then load the ship and get spot prices for that. Very unpredictable, and particularly in the summer when our passenger season is going, it's very difficult to manage the coal pile down at Seward to meet some of the larger ships. But we, 2 years ago, went through a real effort to try to work that particular business harder than we have in the past. And I'm happy to say that's proven to be very profitable. But we're still looking for long-term coal contracts. We have interest now in Chile. We have interest in Japan. We have interest in China. And we've moved sample coal to all those customers. And the number of spot market movements to those customers has gone up this year. If it proves to be true, the way it's going will be it'll almost look like a full-term contract year, except it'll all be spot coal. And what we're really trying to do is tie down a full-term contract that may go on for 5 or 10 years, and then we can put more capital investment into Seward and in turn enhance our ability to turn those ships faster and actually make more money. So coal has been good to us this year, and we're hoping that it's going to be good next year. Passengers, I think the numbers that you've seen we had a record year last year, and if I'm not mistaken, it was the fourth record year in a row in terms of revenue for passengers. That's a combination of rates and volume. I don't think we're going to break our own record again this year, but we're working against a record last year, and we're seeing down about 10 or 11% in pre-bookings, which isn't a disaster by any stretch. I remember 2003, we thought we had a real problem on our hands, and in fact, late bookings turned that into a real good year. I'm not quite as optimistic this year. because we know what's going on out there, and a lot of people are holding on to their dollars, and so we do expect to see a leveling off. I don't think we're going to see a disaster from the railroad's perspective, because as you know, we not only move internal customers here in Alaska, but then we also move external customers, and so we'll still have our internal customers, and a lot of retired individual travelers who are coming back for a second time, and they set their own tours up, and we're still seeing bookings from that group right now. We're in the process of embarking on our, at least since I've been on the railroad, our second five-year plan. The first five-year plan was completed in 2006. We used 2007. We used 2008 as sort of a restructuring year, and then we're embarking on our second five-year plan. And we have not only a five-year plan in place here, but a five-year plan in terms of how we operate the railroad and what our objectives are. We have a rolling five-year set of goals. We have annual goals. And we check those all the way along during the year and report those to our employees so that everybody knows how we're doing. It's a stoplight chart, basically. We'd use green is fine, yellow means we're getting closer, we're doing okay, red means we're not making progress. And that's proven to be effective. 2008 was a tough year. We throttled back on the expense side significantly in 2008. I put a hiring freeze into place in the latter part of 2007, and we've not hired a new employee, in other words, a plus one to the total on the railroad since October of 2007. I personally control hiring one by one, and that hiring freeze lasted through 2008, and it will continue on into 2009. Looking a little bit under the tent in 2009, as we built the 2009 budget, not only do we have the hiring freeze, but for management, I've instituted a pay freeze. And so labor contracts will go as per normal, management pay will freeze, and we have really strengthened our control over the expense side, not knowing exactly how our budget's going to come out in 2009. So we've really tightened up. We've actually brought home a pretty decent budget, but a lot of it depends on Flint Hills, and as long as that's up in the air, the shift in good to bad is so fast and so dramatic if we were to lose Flint Hills that we're being very, very conservative as we go into our 2009 year. I think the other thing that's worth mentioning is one of our capital programs that's significant in our safety area is a program called Collision Avoidance, which basically is designed to automatically prevent any two pieces of equipment on the rail from running together, whether it be work equipment or whether it be trains. We've been working on that project now for 12 years. It's a developmental project, and we were probably very, very early into the technology that would allow us to do this. Now the Congress has mandated all passenger and hazardous material carrying railroads to have one of these in place by 2016, so we're well ahead of the game in terms of the rest of the lower 48. It's going to be hugely expensive, and we've already invested a lot of that expense in Alaska. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're actually doing operational testing of our system right now with the Federal Railroad Administration. So that's consuming part of our capital dollars. I'd like to remind you before I run through some numbers, for those that don't know, and I still always find someone that doesn't quite know that we are, as opposed to an agency that gets a budget from the general fund, an independent business enterprise of the state, owned by the state and governed by the board, but yet we're a profit organization, for profit. The law says be sustainable, but my board says that ain't good enough. You got to be profitable, and not only that, but be profitable running your trains. And so that is where our goals lie. Our employees are railroad employees, and our defined benefit programs and so on are all paid for out of our earnings before we compute our net earnings and go into a capital program. Speaking of dollars, a couple of numbers for you. We generated about $138 million in operating revenue in 2008. That was about 5% up overall, despite the fact that we were down about $4.8 million, as I said before, from Flint Hills this year. On the expense side, benefits were up 34% over 2007. The cost of benefits for the railroad and a defined benefit program are significant. we're able to cover those costs, but I don't know how long we can stand increases like that without the bottom line really being jeopardized. And of course, everything we make in the railroad goes into our capital program. We don't give out dividends or give a dividend to the state or anything like that. We put everything back into capital. So anything that we have to increase there comes off the capital program. Fuel in 2008 for us was up $12 million over budget. We started out at $2.50 a gallon for those locomotives. We jumped to $4 a gallon. And of course, you know, we deal long term with fuel, and so we don't pay the price you see at the pump. We used to hedge fuel, for example. So it's a little bit off what you might have seen, but not far. Now we're back down to around $1.30, which is time to celebrate and do high fives, but it's tough to build a budget in 2009 thinking it's going to stay there. So that's another part of our 2009 budget that we're working to make sure we can accommodate if it goes back up.
Pat, if you just give us a little bit of a lull here. Thank you for Senator Menard joining us. We appreciate that you're with us. Go ahead, Pat. I just wanted to acknowledge that.
She knows one of our board members real well, too. Earnings for 2008, we were down about 20% off what our forecast net earnings were. We came in at about $13 million. We thought we'd come in at about $16 million. So I guess all things considered in 2008, that really wasn't a bad show. Our capital program in 8 was about $93 million, and $42 million of that was from bonds. $23 million of that was from formula funds that all railroads that carry passengers in the country get these formula funds. The total assets of the railroad have been increasing nicely every year, as they did again in 2008, and we're probably up in the neighborhood of, when we audit out this year, we'll be in the $850 million category in terms of total assets, which is a nice place to be also. A peek under the tent in 2009, we're looking for a little under a 3% increase in revenues. Flint Hills is actually forecasting to be up over the 2008 levels. You know, we had the petroleum refinery fire. Flint Hills has picked up some of the slack in that, and it's not necessarily from anything happening at the airport. It's the fact that they're substituting in, and we'll have to wait and see if that comes true. But right now, we're encouraged to see those numbers go up a little bit. They give us a forecast on a regular basis all year long, and it constantly changes as they adjust it. We've got two new rail cars coming in that offer a premium class service. They've just arrived. They'll go into service this summer for the first time, and that will also help increase revenue. And then off the expense line, with the price of fuel being down, that's going to help us considerably as well. We've got two labor contracts that'll kick in this year. We're negotiating one we'll start negotiating with. We didn't have any that were due in 2008. We're working one of those contracts, and we'll start working the other one. But overall, labor contract raises will all go up as programmed. There's nothing in that area that will slow that down, and that's probably going to jump expenses probably by a couple of $1 million. We're about 50 to 52% of our expenses are in the labor area. And as I said before, management's going to take a pay freeze, and that'll probably help us out with about $400,000 of expenses that'll be avoided. In our capital program, as I said before, we're in year number 4 of our track program to rebuild the line from Anchorage to Fairbanks. And that's where we sold the bonds, and that was what I mentioned just a couple minutes ago. That program is working very nicely, and we're on budget and on the timeline to complete that program in 2012 or the first of 2013 as programmed. 2 years in a row, I got the question here, how many moose have we killed this year? The answer is 60, as opposed to 29 last year, for anybody who's tracking that sort of thing. I noticed on the highway, they're killing a lot more this year, too. On the personnel side, we had a reduction in the size of the railroad. We laid off about 20% of our management team, about 10% overall of the railroad. And what I did is, through attrition, when I froze all the jobs, vacancies were created, and then I took those vacancies. And after I took the vacancies, I reorganized the railroad in order to then accommodate where the vacancies were, where I could consolidate and move people up and around to cover the new organization. There were about 80 people involved in that. There were about, I believe it turned out to be 10 non-voluntary layoffs that were involved with those 80 positions. I think at that point, I will go ahead and stop and open it up to questions because I have more gee whiz facts and figures, but I think a lot of those things really don't necessarily get to the heart of the issues that your constituents are interested in. So if that's okay, Madam Chair, I'll kind of halt the Chamber of Commerce speech there and open it up to the committee.
Okay. Kathy, do you have any questions? I cut you off early last time, so I want to give you a chance to be the first one this time.
Thank you.
Any other questions from anyone else?
Madam Chair, you should know better.
Representative
than
Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I hear you say you're paying $1.09 for diesel?
No, $1.30.
$1.30 for diesel. That's still pretty good. And how much is it? Is that like highway diesel? Same as a truck would use? Or is it
sulfur diesel. And you have to remember, you know, we don't just go out and deal with a pump price. We have a sort of a give-and-take relationship when prices are high and prices are low with the refinery itself, because we actually have to use diesel to move their diesel. And so we have a give-and-take relationship that offsets some of the cost of moving their product to the airport. Because we don't own that product, we just move it. But we pay to move it by using their diesel at their price. And so we work that out.
Sounds like the North Slope using gas to produce oil. The other question I have, if I might, Madam Chair, you had the increases. Do you have new contracts or are these bumps in negotiated contracts? What, you said there was going to be an increase in labor costs?
Yeah, they're not all new contracts, although what we typically will do on the management side is we'll come into a negotiation with a number of the items in the contract. There may be 5, 10, 15, depending on how big the contract is, that we would like to adjust or bargain for. And so in some cases, if you're really going for a lot of the items, it may look like a new contract, but essentially it's based on the last year's contract or the last signed contract.
If I could, Madam Chair, I was looking, I saw an employee representation of mostly unions. One has 10 and one has 283. Are we talking about negotiating with a 10-member collective bargaining agreement, or are we talking about a 280, or both?
You notice that one of them on there is 121. That's the one we're negotiating with right now. That actually, when they all come to work, that's a snapshot in time, by the way, because that's always a moving target.
Right.
So that's a snapshot on the day you see there. They're actually closer to 200, maybe about 195 at full up. And we're negotiating with them. That's our train and engine men, the crews themselves. And then the 10 are the controllers that sit behind the computer and watch the screen and watch the trains and give them their authorities to go or stop or go into a siding or whatever. And there's 10 of them that are union. And then we have 5 unions overall.
So a third of your workforce, basically, roughly, just
500 and... Well, out of 715...
Of the unionized, I guess it'd be
the
way.
You're in the 500s. The mid-500s are unionized.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I represent Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said something in your presentation about the board's mandate to you is not just to be profitable, but be profitable by running your trains. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. You know, our sources of revenue are many. For example, I mentioned the federal formula funds that are given to transit railroads, and we qualify as a transit railroad. Railroads typically look at their train performance, and they call that an operating ratio, and they take operating revenues that are earned from customers by operating trains, and they take operating expenses such as crew costs and fuel and things like that. And they divide the expenses by the revenues, and it comes out a ratio. The lower that ratio, the better. And it's a determinant in how effective your actual train operation is as opposed to other sources of revenue. So our board said, Pat, you know, you can't cover up by getting these federal dollars and counting them as revenue and saying you're doing great if your trains aren't making money. And given the state of play in Alaska, it is a real challenge to try to make just the train operations profitable. And so that is a lot of where our expense control and looking for new business is focused, is to get that operating ratio down as low as we can get it. The big roads in the south don't operate passengers and freight together. And so you can optimize an operating ratio by that they all gave up passengers. It's labor intensive and the fare box just doesn't produce like a freight car does. So, you know, you'll see them in the mid-70s to the mid-80s, 0.75 to 0.85 in an operating ratio, whereas a good day for the Alaska Railroad would be a year where I come in and say 0.95 is what we achieve. We're trying to get it lower, and maybe someday we will if we can develop some of this new business.
Thank you, Mayor. Thanks.
I just want to make a comment. If I remember right, when I've taken part before in something like this, that the railroad even has rents land out, right? And so are you counting that? You're saying that those things you count separate?
That's correct. The real estate department, the railroad was endowed with 36,000 acres. About half of it is leasable. About half of that is leased. But that does not count against operating ratio. It's a separate source of revenue.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johansson.
Thanks. Just two update questions. We had a couple bills last year on land conveyances, and one had to do with the Parks Highway in Wasilla and another one up in the Fairbanks International Airport. Are those part of your plan that you alluded to, the realignments that you're going to finish up in 2012?
No, neither. Those are separate issues.
Okay.
Those are separate real estate issues from the 2012 thing was the rebuild of the actual track main line itself.
So has this taken place? Have you guys followed through with
the land conveyances?
Yeah.
No, they are not complete yet.
And any problems with that going on? Or?
Well, land conveyance is always a problem because there's so many actors that are involved. And each case is a little bit different. We have constituents in Healy, for example, that would like to buy their property. We have crossing issues where someone has a crossing coming out of an area of business and they want that crossing to stay there, but it's not theirs and they don't pay for it. And the railroad didn't put it there in the first place, and so it's called an orphan. Nobody wants it.
Right.
And so there's many, many, many different cases like this, and we work each one of them with an actual committee in the railroad independently, one after another.
But specifically, Madam Chair, these are specifically, looks like you're dealing with DOT. I mean, are you guys, you can get back to me, I mean, if it's off the top of your head. But
I can give you an update on those two specifically in detail. But yes, we do deal with DOT. We work with them very closely on crossing issues, as a matter of fact, and land conveyance issues. We've got a land conveyance issue working right now in Anchorage.
Okay.
And there's a couple of other constituent issues as well. So there are several in the hopper right now.
Yeah, I was just curious about these two that we put in legislation. I see Wendy nodding her head, so she'll get that information.
If I can get back to you on that, we'll be happy to.
And
follow up.
Two more. One is deal with Klutna, the 48 acres. How's that going?
You know, we went in with a proposal. It's going well. We went in with a proposal to solve the quarry issue, which was a village and a native corporation issue combined. And it was the lightning rod that wouldn't let anything else go on between us and the Klutna. And we share a lot of property together and a lot of ideas on what to do with that property. So by going back a little bit to refresh memory, we reached an agreement on the quarry. That quarry now has been deeded over to a Klutna Inc. The village is satisfied. We pulled the rail up to the quarry and left it back in its original shape as much as original can be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is over and done with now. And we have since moved on to another project at Birchwood, which is a gravel project in which for the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to move several 100,000 tons of gravel out of their pit in Birchwood. We're going to put a rail in there and pay for part of that operation, and they're going to pay for part of it, and we're going to partner together to move gravel out. That's the second phase. And the third phase is we're going to work to see if we can do a large land swap along the lines of what you were talking about before, where they can develop houses on a contiguous piece of property that they have with ours, and we in turn will get some more property in another area that will serve our interests for the railroad.
I just had one more question.
One more, go ahead.
In looking at this that you've handed out to the committee, it talks about Seward Freight Dock and the Whittier Master Plan. And if you guys could maybe get back to me, I see numbers and how many acres it's going to increase the area, but I'd like some information, and you don't have to do it now, but gather that information about what is that going to do for the volume of freight? What is that literally going to do to the activity in those two ports? Details later, but if you want to comment on it.
Well, a quick answer is we're anticipating pipeline. And as a port, extending the dock, bringing pipe in, and laying the pipe down, shipload of pipe while we load the train and move the train out. We don't have any room to do that. We've got the property, but it's not ready. And what we want to do is ready that property in a laydown yard because of the anticipation of the huge quantity of pipe that's going to come in. In terms of what it will do down there, really nothing. It's all within the confines of the yard. Basically, it'll clean the yard off, level it, and just create a laydown yard.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I can send you a map that'll show you exactly where it was, the acreage on there. More. Sure.
I have a question right now. Is the railroad concerned? Because, I mean, you go to these ports, and we've heard about the endangered species and that they're trying to get the whales. And I don't know how far they are with that, but it's a concern because it might make a difference how those ports are taking care of business. And so is that of a concern for you for the railroad?
I would say it's a secondary concern to us because we have rail access into Whittier, we have rail access into the Port of Anchorage, and we have rail access into Seward. And so anything that would stifle the business activity in those ports would secondarily hit the railroad. So while I'm not on the front lines on that in terms of my concern, I'm certainly keeping track of it and watching it to see if there would be an impact on the railroad at some point.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the pipeline and gearing up for that. Is your infrastructure up to snuff? I know we've got, DOT's got bridges that won't hold a pipe that they can't transport it across. Is everything that you have, can you load your cars with the pipe and get it across now, or do you have any infrastructure that needs to be upgraded between now and the time we start shipping pipe to Fairbanks?
We have some things that we must do to offload the ships. It's mostly at the port level. We have some things we'd like to do that are going to make the transit more efficient and more effective up to where the transload is, wherever it goes on a truck and goes on. The determination as to whether we have to have those or whether it's nice to have, I think is going to happen when they run their logistics models and look at the velocity of goods and services going back and forth and look at the cost of something going slow versus something going fast, something going by rail versus something going by truck. That's not going to happen right away. We're in discussion with Denali, and we're in discussion with TransCanada both. And while they're very, very early in their logistics plans, they haven't built them yet. And they're probably not going to show their cards until open season is through. And then the logistics guys are going to be all over this project, in my estimation, and we'll have a better idea. In the meantime, we're sort of testing each other out. They've got some things that they'll tell us, and we'll tell them anything, both of them. Because as far in advance as we can learn what they need, we want to get started on it. But there are some things right at the ports that I would say we have to do to be effective.
Follow-up, yeah. Representative.
Are there any, like, line straightening or bridges outside the port area that we're looking at? Are you up to speed on that aspect of it?
I think by the time we actually go for it, we will, with our own money, have finished what little there is left. And we've, as I said before, spent 7 years working on a lot of the line. We've done an awful lot of that. We've also had a huge bridge program, which will continue over the next several years. We'll work more south towards Seward, which is kind of a light volume area in terms of gross weight. The big gross weight is north where the coal and the gravel is, and that's all taken care of. And I've gone out on record saying, hey, we're ready. We're ready for a pipeline. We can move pipe now. We can move it more efficiently if we do a couple of these other projects at the port.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't see any other questions, but I do have, Pat, can you go into a little bit, because you do want a little help from the state for in case something happens with the Flint Hills refinery. So can you go into a little more detail on that for us here?
Sure. I think when Governor Palin made the statement in the paper that it was in the best interest to look to see if we could keep that refinery open, it really triggered some things that were trying to happen, but that put focus to it. And what we're trying to do is, through Flint Hills' eyes, look at what their value chain is and what they came into it expecting to do and what they can or can't do with the situation that they're currently in, to try to figure out where their corporate decision-making is coming from and what could influence it. By the same token, as we look at the possibility of them either throttling back or actually shutting down and going to a terminal-only operation where they would just fill their tanks up and trucks would get fuel out of their tanks, they wouldn't refine anything. If that was to happen and the state decided it wanted to somehow keep the refinery operating through the state, are there any viable options to doing that didn't involve, you know, huge subsidies? Is there a way to be profitable or at least break even on a sustainable basis? There's an awful lot of stuff being thrown around about that, but really it's a business case. It's just a simple matter of, it's just a matter of sitting down and running the business case on each one of the good ideas that people have. Yeah, the railroad should own it, okay? You know, what are the conditions? What are the costs? What are the revenues? How does the railroad make money if it no longer has a customer to charge to move petroleum, for example? That's where we make our money. If it's all state petroleum and state rail cars and state refinery, how do we make our money?
What was the percentage again of your business? I can't.
About 40% overall of the business. So you actually have to run the numbers and compute each business case and look at what the value is to the state. And one value to the state, for example, that Flint Hills does not calculate is jobs. And particularly now in the national economic scene, we're seeing that that's a priority, is to keep those jobs until we get through this hard time. And so turning around and automatically letting 700 jobs go down the tubes may not politically be the right thing. So the state is going to have a value compilation that's going to look different than Flint Hills' value compilation. When you add up the state's value compilation, if they can't get the best for all Alaskans through what the state can do, but getting Flint Hills to get back profitable enough with the guarantee that they would start investing in order to expand that refinery, which is what they really wanted to do when they came in, it may turn out that keeping them in the game actually gets the best for all Alaskans. We don't know that until we run the numbers. And so Flint Hills is running numbers, DNR is running numbers, and the railroad is running numbers right now. And we've been to several meetings between all the parties. DNR has brokered those meetings. They've done a great job. And I think at the end of the day, when the answer comes out, and the Constitution says the legislature shall determine who gets the best for all Alaskans, when we present the options to the legislature, you will know we've really done our homework and cranked these numbers. And so what we're telling you is based on fact, as opposed to just speculation. We probably got about two more months before we would expect to start to see some fallout from the work that's being done by the three parties right now.
Okay, so that would be March or April? March, maybe?
February, March. I'd say around April Fool's.
Just in time for special session.
So right now, you don't have any numbers or anything like that?
No, we don't have any numbers right now, but I will say that the fact that the price of gas is where it is, Flint Hills will readily tell you they are making money now. And making money is not a bad thing. I mean, we're all in it to make some money. It's how much and how. And so as long as Flint Hills is able to say, okay, we've got the time to continue to look at this, at $140 a barrel, they were losing money, and And their corporate decision was this far, in my estimation, from just shutting the operation down. Tesoro, I just saw a briefing from them the other day. The charts were all the same. If you just changed the name from Tesoro to Flint Hills, you would have been looking at the same charts. They were losing money too. So this gives us some breathing room to do these calculations and give a better answer, I think, at the end of the day.
Okay, and I'm just, what I'm trying to actually look at in my head is where which direction the help needs to go if we do help. I mean, do we help Flint Hills? Do we do it, give it to the railroad and say, you buy them? Do we say as a state, well, we'll take it over and we will do it? I mean, there's several different avenues and different directions that we could go, and I'm just trying to kind of just feel a little bit which direction that is possible, and right now it doesn't sound like we can do that yet.
We can't. What we can do is look at a couple of what I call sort of the boundaries of the problem. One, the law states that the Alaska Railroad is supposed to be operated on a sustainable basis, independent of the general fund. If whatever we come up with requires us to change that, that probably would not be a good idea, because the model right now for the railroad is a pretty darn good one, and it's lasted this long. Mm-hmm. It's proven, it works, and maybe that's not something the state would want to do. There's a couple other boundaries like that too. The numbers that we're going to present are not going to have politics tied into them. But and that's where I think the discussion up here is going to be of interest to us, because in the governor's office, when you look at the energy state and look at the national look that we're getting from the outside, if the closing of that refinery creates a situation where we have to import our energy from the desert to get the ultra-low sulfur, to push to the interior and to the north in order to build the gas pipeline in order to get the energy out, that's not a business model I think would come out of Harvard Business School. That has a lot of political ramifications tied to it, I think, and I think those debates have yet to be had. I think some are already thinking of that and saying, you know, and that's why some are saying it's in our best interest to try to keep this refinery going. Because otherwise, I mean, we're just out of schlitz. We have to bring everything in, and it's going to mostly come in by tanker, and it's going to be the cheapest fuel anybody can get, and that's probably going to come straight from the Middle East. And that's very ironic to see all that going north by rail instead of our fuel being refined and coming south by rail to customers.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, then we will adjourn. I'd like to thank the department for taking the time to bring us up to speed on the aviation. I think they're mostly gone right now, on the aviation division. And also, Pat, I really appreciate you traveling all this way to talk with us. And next meeting will be Thursday in room 17, and it will be at 1 o'clock. And we will be hearing from the department once again on the DOT's overview of the federal stimulus package and what it means to DOT. So stay tuned for good information. So thank you very much, and we are adjourned.